Are we okay? Now we got it. I hope you permit me just a few words here as the first time in the pulpit. And it's such a great, it's a special thing. I preach quite a lot in various churches, but it's a very special thing. I tell you, about 2 years ago, we were just briefly visiting, and there was a market around the church here. And my wife and I said, well, we're kind of Methodists. Why don't we just... So we went in and looked around for an old bulletin, finally found one. The church was so beautifully kept that we had to really scrabble in the garbage can to find a bulletin. And I've been training pastors in several denominations for over 30 years. And, you know, sometimes interesting things happen. And I opened this bulletin up, and I did one of these cartoon double takes. Neil Lefwich? No. So I went to the church secretary and said, now, is the pastor here, did he come from Western Pennsylvania? Yes. And we were just absolutely delighted to find out that we had landed somehow. So I told Neil recently, now that he's moving from Yuma, I'm not sure we're going to come back. because he and his wife are very, very close to us. And I often wondered, and I have to wonder, because I've trained, and this is going to probably surprise you, both Protestants and Catholics. And I have ministers I've helped train all over the United States and Canada. And not a few of them are priests. And I can tell you, I'm not, and some of them are bishops. And I got to tell you, I'm not all that happy about some of them, okay? But I'm really happy about Neil and his wife, Judy. Actually, Judy worked for me as a student back there in those old days. So it's a special feeling. Maybe some of you have had this as teachers or supervisors or in the military. 30 years later, you close a circle with someone that you helped train or prepare, and it's a very, very special, warm, wonderful feeling. So thanks very much for this occasion. Now, just a word about what we're going to be doing. You may know, or maybe not know, it's hard to take the seminary professor out of me, that the United Methodist Church, along with Presbyterian Church and the Episcopal Church, the Anglican Church in Canada, the United Church of Canada, where we are sometimes, Lutheran Church, we all share in the readings that we use on Sundays. And so millions of others like you in the United States and Canada today are paying attention to these same readings. It's called the lectionary, and it's on a three-year cycle. And each year, one of the Gospels is the focus point so that we can be led by this different and specific picture of who Jesus was. And this is the year of St. Mark. And so I decided that not only would I accept the invitation to preach early in this church year, because it starts in Advent, but also offer a series on Mark. I don't know how many times I've taught Mark, but, you know, we're told as aging people, aren't we? Keep doing something fresh and new. So several weeks ago, I decided that I would translate fresh from Greek several passages in Mark and then use them in teaching. And one of the ones I translated is actually the appointed reading for today. So if you're used to looking in a text of your own and following along, don't. Because this is my own translation of that passage. Let us listen carefully and prepare our hearts. If you'd follow in your bulletin, please, with the prayer for understanding. Speak to us your word, O God, that we may hear Jesus' call to be his disciples. Amen. And hear now the word of the Lord according to Mark. Just after the time John the Baptist had been thrown into prison, Jesus began to visit around the whole area of Galilee, proclaiming the good news of God. And here is the kind of thing he said. We are on the very cusp of God with us, really. It might as well be here. In fact, it's right here in our midst and has been here already. You had better turn yourselves around and reach out in belief of this good news. And then one day, as he was passing by the shores of the Lake of Galilee itself, he saw two brothers, fisher folks, called Simon and Andrew. They worked together, casting amphibious small nets into the lake. And so Jesus said to them, "Come on, drop that net of yours. Just step out and join up with me. I'll teach you another kind of fishing, the kind of fishing that nets people." And just like that, they dropped their nets and did what he asked. They stepped out, and took up with him. And going along just a bit farther by the lake, he saw two other fishers, James, the elder son of a man called Zebedee, and also his brother called John. They were working a different kind of net with a full crew in a boat, working a big drag net. Right away, Jesus calls out to them, and they also dropped everything, leaving the boat and net to be crewed by the hired men of their father, and stepped out and went along with Jesus. The word of the Lord. "I'm on," he says. "Am I on?" "I'm on." I've translated this piece that's being read by millions today in a quite particular way in order to emphasize certain things about it. And what's interesting about the reading, the way Mark creates it, and by the way, there's nothing accidental, it's all purposeful. It's interesting because of what's missing. You might have expected a kind of a Q&A when saying, "Well, how are we going to catch people in a net, and how are we going to live?" And there's nothing like that. There's no conversation. There's no reluctance. There's just an instant sense of call. And they respond to it, all four of them, in the same way. And it's a picture of what it means to be a disciple. And Mark is particular in this. It's the only gospel this way. Mark doesn't even like particularly the word disciple. He likes verbs. Remember those sixth grade grammar lessons you had when they made you draw on the blackboard, you know, what's a verb, what's a noun, what's a modifier? You understand? Well, Mark likes verbs. For him, the chief verb is follow. I translate it step out, join up. That's all that's required. No catechesis, no training, no questions, no qualifications, huh? Just do it, to quote a famous company housed in Portland, Oregon. Step out, follow, do it. And then this strange thing that you might think really leaves open too much. He says, "I'll make you fishers of people." He's inviting them to work without a net. How do you work without a net? How do you catch people without a net? Now, I never preach a warmed over sermon. And as I've been working on this one for the last few weeks, spent a lot of time thinking about it. And instantly, I remembered a personal story. And I want to tell you about it. I was about to enter seminary myself, just as the Vietnam War was warming up. Now, going into seminary, I had an exemption, but I didn't want to take it. And so I volunteered for a program that was offered at that time, in which the Army commissioned me as a lieutenant, as a chaplain while still in seminary, if I agreed to spend all of my time, spare time, being trained. And that's what I wanted to do. And I even thought that time, I'd kind of like to spend my life as a military chaplain. Didn't work out that way, but that was my idea. And I took a lot of training, most of it in the classroom, some of it marching. And you know, chaplains don't get to get trained or have fun with big boy war toys. They never let me throw a grenade. They never let me fire a bazooka. They never allowed me to drive a tank or yank a lanyard on a howitzer. None of that fun stuff, huh, that big boys like. But they did let me do something. We were taken to Fort Dix. How many, is there anybody here who ever was at Fort Dix in the military? Oh, I got one back there, one here. And they took us on field training at Fort Dix. And finally, I began to have a little fun, although it was kind of boring because we didn't get to play with the toys. But one night, they took us to what they call the infiltration course. Some of you went through that. Did anybody go through an infiltration course in military? There you go. There you go. Big muddy field with barbed wire strung about that high. And your idea was to crawl under it, not get caught. And when I went there, I saw that they had about an E3, very bored looking, behind a 50 caliber machine gun. But I noticed that shrouded around the machine gun was a plywood cutout, so he couldn't depress it so as to kill you or elevate it so as to get in trouble somewhere else. He just sat there and fired spurts of tracers, which I thought were awful pretty. And they had simulated mortars going off, boom, you know, but they were obviously simulated. Now, you may think I'm a little nuts, but I said, boy, this looks like fun. Because it didn't look dangerous to me. I knew what danger was because I worked on a pond as a pond monkey on a woodpecker sawmill in Oregon and almost got killed by logs and sawdust several times. So I knew what danger was, and this didn't look like danger. It looked like fun. So I really enjoyed getting down, and I was crawling under the barbed wire and all those beautiful tracers going overhead, and I'm kind of enjoying it and trying to make it last because, you know, they're not letting us do anything else fun. And all of a sudden, I hear from far off, "Chaplain Hewitt, move it." So I wiggle some more, and alongside of me comes a recruit. And he's got his rifle, and all of a sudden, there's some light flashing overhead. And he turns over and looks at me, and I look at him. I said, "How's it going, son?" I'm 21, he's 18. And he looked at me, and he did a double take. He said, "Where's your rifle, buddy?" And I knew what he was worried about, because if I should have had a rifle and I didn't, everybody was going to get punished real big. And I said to him, "Son, they don't let me carry a rifle. I'm a chaplain." And he said, "Well," he said, "then, what the hell are you doing out here, chaplain?" Working without a rifle. Yeah, the only thing we can do is throw a little scarf over the hood of a Humvee and say the Eucharist or sit in a protected Humvee out in Iraq with the fellas and wait to get hit. I got a confession here. My wife, the only time we really came close to divorce, I finally divulged to her at the age of 67. I called the chief of chaplains at the Pentagon and I said, "Reactivate me and send me to Iraq." He laughed. I said, "I'm in better shape than a lot of your 45-year-olds and they've got families. Put me over there. I want to go." He said, "Well, chaplain, we're not going to call up any of you guys." Working without a rifle, working without a net. You know, it might seem that that's just left hanging out there, but it's not. Because if you follow Mark, Jesus shows them exactly what it is that attracts, that brings in, that draws, that catches people. He demonstrates it. It's clear. There's nothing fuzzy about what you have to do. The first thing he does to demonstrate how you bring people in without a net is to create this community he creates that is totally unique. He's gathered together people that don't belong together. And in those difficult times in Palestine, you had to be the right kind of person in the right kind of place. People were separated by religion, by rank, by ethnicity, by language, by oppressor, by suppressed, by peasant, by landowner. Everything was separated. Everybody was in their own place. Everybody did the right thing. Jesus broke it all down and brought together a community that was astounding. And so that picture of 12 sort of ordinary guys following Jesus around as a little unit, Mark doesn't agree with. He plays a kind of a story trick. At the very end, when Jesus is dying, he describes a group of women, names about three of them, and then says, and a whole bunch of other women who had been with him the whole time taking care of him in Galilee. And so you have to go back and reread the story and say, there was a whole bunch of folks. There are times in Mark's gospel when what happens is that there's no room for people. There's so many around him. And so we have to picture and reread the story. There's all kinds of women of different ranks who shouldn't be together, and they shouldn't be out there with men. And they're there taking care of Jesus. We can have a little fun with this, I think. You know, some of us know what it means to be taken care of by women, right? Thank God. And I sometimes wonder how they took care of him. I wonder if one of those women ever said to Jesus, "What was the last time you washed your feet?" Or maybe he said to one of them, said, "You know what? You're not eating right. You can't go on like this if you don't start eating better." Things like this. A few days ago, my wife said to me, she said, "Well, you didn't come down here planning to preach." And she said, I'm worried about how you're going to look on the platform. And so she went to the Goodwill here and she bought me a pair of chinos for $6. She waited until it was the right color. And then I put them on this morning. She said, "Now, for gosh sakes, don't put your hand in your pocket because there's a big white spot here where they..." No. At one point, the blood family of Jesus, this is only in Mark, Mark says the blood family of Jesus was hearing about what he was doing, who he was collecting together, the kinds of things he was doing, and they thought maybe he had gone crazy. And they came and tried to take him away. The blood family. A little bit later, we see a picture where all these people that don't belong together are gathered all around him, and the family's outside. And somebody says, "Your family's here. They're looking for you." And he said, "No, that's fine. Leave them there. Here's my family right around me. These are my mother, my brother, my sisters." You know why they're my family? Because these are the ones doing the will of God. Now, that's something everybody wants to be a part of. And when the world sees that kind of thing happening, you don't need a net to draw people in. Other way he taught them, he said, I love that Neil's got these. The other thing he did, taught them about, here's how you fish without nets. You break people's chains. That's what the world wants. They want somebody who can break chains. And he does it. He breaks the chains of people with tormented minds and souls and spirits, economically set loose from their land and starving, people homeless, people without a place, people who have been shamed outside of their families. He breaks all those chains. That's how you fish without a net, says Mark. Another way, it's totally astounding, is he says, let me teach you a new kind of wisdom. If you want power, do you want to achieve? Do you want to be somebody special? Do you have ambitions? Good for you, says Jesus. Let me teach you true ambition. True ambition is the ambition to serve better than anybody else. Let's make the number one most honored person the one who serves best. Totally reversing the way the world works. Now, it's fine to be skeptical about that just being preacher talk or pie in the sky or yeah, it sounds good, but it doesn't work. And it's been demonstrated to work again and again. I hope you have seen the film Selma, or will see it, or at least on Martin Luther King's Day, recently, last week, that you reflected on his life. And if you go see that film and recall the events, what you'll remember is that a Southern Negro Baptist preacher brought the President of the United States and the Congress to its knees simply by non-violent service. And Jews and Orthodox and Catholic nuns and priests and preachers and everybody from across the United States seeing that flooded to his side, and the weight of people saying, this is wrong, it has to be made right, changed a nation. I've been a great admirer of Pope Francis. Finally, we have a pope who's reaching back for the wisdom of Jesus in Mark. He knows you can't change the problems of the Vatican, and we know they're deep and nasty. You can't change those by legislation or structural change. And so instead, what he is doing is simply acting like Jesus in Mark. Reaching out in simple compassion, washing the feet of prisoners and women, all the time the old fogies, well, let me just go ahead and call them the old farts of the Vatican, standing there saying, did I say that, Neil? Am I allowed to say that in your church? Okay. I was a dean of a Roman Catholic seminary for 8 years. I learned tremendous respect for the Roman Catholic Church. I have priests, former students all over this country. I love the church, and it does us no good when we as Protestants are happy about their problems. It does no good to the cause of Christ. But it's a shame on Christianity. He is changing it. Even though they are criticizing him openly and standing behind him saying, basta, basta, enough, it's not correct. He's reaching out. He's standing up and saying, who am I to judge a homosexual? Last week in the Philippines, he was at a meeting. Hardly any women were present. He looked out. He paused. He said, why are there no women here? He's reaching into that depth of moral wisdom. The way we get our power best as Christians is in acting simply in service. We live some of the time on the Oregon coast in a very isolated little community. And there, we support and tithe, in fact, to a little Episcopal mission, a little poor little mission. We do that because it's the only church in town where everybody is welcome. And it's kind of more like a fuel station for just nitty-gritty folks out in the community doing work. And my wife does, without pay, as a licensed psychologist, work for the juvenile court with abused children. I'm an advocate in the court for children, abused children, on my spare time. And everybody in that congregation is out there reaching. Now, in that community, there's a very rare person She's a Tongan. And through some strange kind of circumstance, she married a man, a paraplegic, from that town 40 years ago. She came as the only person of color in the village, someone everybody thought was kind of an exotic attraction, but nobody of particular interest. And slowly her Wesleyan Methodist roots in Tonga became evident as making her a person of special quality. And eventually she became the safety net in the community and became a deacon. So if you're in that little community and there's somebody who's ended up under the bridge with a hacking cough, she's the one down there with food and a sleeping blanket. If a Mexican immigrant appears pregnant and ready to give birth at a motel, a couple little seedy motels we have in that village, they don't call social services, they call the Tongan deacon. She knows where every single homeless teenager lives in the woods. She makes the circuit, bringing them food and blankets, trying to help them find their way. She has no tolerance for government interference. She has no tolerance for committees. When she goes to a meeting concerned with social issues, she'll listen for a while, and then she will stand up and speak. And when she begins to speak, the entire room goes dead silent. She's spoken. And they will do what she says. The other day, because of the threat of tsunami, they knocked down the old high school because they have to move everything up to the upper crest. And she showed up at a meeting and she said, you can knock down everything else. This is just a little Tongan deacon. She says, you can knock down everything you want to. Leave me the dining hall and the kitchen because I'm feeding the poor. And I got to have a kitchen. Okay, we'll leave it. What Santita says becomes the act. How does she get that kind of power? Because they know she walks the walk. Years ago, Neil in Ohio, they took a survey and they tried to find out. It was a very interesting question. Just let's do a scientific survey of everybody who lives in Ohio. And at least a fair sampling, and we will find out the esteem or respect people have for all the religious groups in Ohio. And Ohio is a huge place. Here's what happened. The religious group that most Ohioans have the most respect for is the Salvation Army. Any surprise? Between college and seminary, I had a job for a year as a social worker with the Salvation Army as a lay employee on Skid Row. They gave me a key and a door and a desk and a telephone and a little bundle of chits. I could buy somebody a bowl of chili and a glass of milk. That was it. They said, see, the line forms around the block. Take care of these people. But you haven't got any money. I said, well, I was wet behind the ears. I was scared. I said, well, what am I going to do? So, well, just you got a telephone. Call around. So somebody would come in. They've got a complicated problem. I have this little directory of social services and government agencies, and I find something. I stick my finger. I say, well, that sounds like the right one. I'd call the number, and I'd say, this is Kempton Hewitt. I'm with the Salvation Army on Skid Row. I need some help. Yes. What do you need? Every time. I didn't have money, but I had the moral authority of what the Salvation Army does, did, and continues to do. You hear me? You understand where I'm going with this? It works. And it's Christianity at its best. And it's what we are constantly called back to. The church gets in trouble when it tries or attempts to act like a corporation. It constantly attempts to organize itself, it seems, as if we are using the tools outside of what gospel taught us the tools are. Neil, I've often thought, as I said, a lot of the people I've educated are bishops, Catholic and Protestant. But I'm not sure we elect them the right way. I said this in the first service, and you got a big kick out of it, but I'm kind of serious. I think what they ought to do, when they come together at a jurisdictional conference to elect a bishop, have somebody go back to the kitchen and find out who's washing the dishes. Bring them up here. Okay, you understand service. You're the bishop. We are better off as a church, as a people, when we vest ourselves in acquiring the moral authority that comes from doing what Jesus taught us to do in working without a net. And God bless us as we pledge to do so. Amen.